from Australia. That's the Shaolin Afronauts. Yes, that's their name. The Shaolin Afronauts with the A-side of their debut 12-inch vinyl single, Journey Through Time. The Shaolin Afronauts started out in 2008, heavily influenced by 1970s West African music, most notably that of Fela Anikula Pokuti, as well as Sun Ra, the great avant-garde jazz artist and soul artist, and a healthy smattering of traditional African and Afro-Cuban rhythms. Music, it's a universal language. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today, another installment on the Clinton Foundation and its related shenanigans. Charles Ortel, a former Wall Street banker and investor who's digging into the financials of General Electric in 2007-2008, proved that the conglomerate had fraudulently overvalued its stock by hundreds of billions, that's with a B, of dollars. He has been detailing here on Lead Stories major financial and accountability problems with the international philanthropic conglomerate operating as the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. Today, Charles Ortel, who has charged that the foundation is engaging in massive charity fraud, takes us into the Clintons' hidden world, where money, politics, and raw power intersect. His sweeping overview puts into perspective many unanswered questions about how the foundation has managed to evade scrutiny, how the Clintons leveraged political power and influence for financial gain, and he's going to connect the dots to the current president, President Barack Obama, explaining a special relationship between the Clintons and the president, and which again brings the foundation into the crosshairs, because they're all connected. And I'm so thankful to have Charles Ortel with us. This is the finest and most authoritative analysis we can get. This is a person who devoted a number of years just literally singularly taking on GE and exposing it. And here he has devoted about 15 months so far in looking into the details of how this so-called foundation operates. And he says the numbers are telling a story of massive, massive fraud. So I welcome you again today, Charles. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Eutrice. It's a pleasure.
Well, you know, this is interesting that, you know, the timing couldn't be more fortuitous, because we were talking about the foundation and then a number of things started happening on the sidelines. We had the confirmation that Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, a very close friend and operative of the Clintons, is in himself in the crosshairs of the FBI and the Justice Department. And the probe allegedly concerns illegal campaign contributions that were gained during the time that Mr. McAuliffe was a board member of the Clinton Foundation. You dealt with that yesterday. And yesterday, we learned that the State Department, Inspector General of the State Department, issued a report saying that indeed Mrs. Clinton appears to have violated the security rules of the department with respect to setting up her independent personal server in her home, and that in fact there were instances in which there were attempts to hack into it that were not reported, and her claim that it was secure and it was just a matter of convenience appears not to be really holding up. It appears that there's something else happening here. Now, in discussing the Clintons and the centrality of this foundation that they're running, this philanthropy, which you say is just a total scam, and relating this to the IG's report about the server, what came to mind to you? Because you, in a way, you're a detective. You're looking at connections between things and among things and among people. What was your natural instinct when you learned about the IG's report?
Well, I was pleased to see that it was so definitive. I was pleased that it was authored by a Democrat who was confirmed, who was put up for the job, I believe, by President Obama, so that the Clintons cannot say this is all George Bush's fault or a Republican witch hunt. And I'm actually pleased that the public is getting engaged on this issue, because the data that and the information and the contacts and connections that the Clintons have been monetizing, particularly in the period 2001 to the present, are the property of we the people, all Americans, on the left, the right, the center, those who don't care about politics. These people have been, feel, it would seem, judging from their behavior, that they're entitled, because of their, in quotes, government service and all their sacrifices, to go about monetizing this information. And what do I mean by that? The information that the Secretary of State's office gets concerning what's going on around the world has enormous value. Business and politics intersect now. They intersect nationally, regionally, globally. And so, you know, business leaders need the State Department and vice versa. Favors are traded. Foreign government leaders need to, after they leave office in the Western world, they need to support themselves. Same here in the United States. You can't live like a foreign leader, even on $1 million a year, or a U.S. president. You've got to be making tons and tons of money to actually pay for private jet travel and suites and all this kind of stuff. So there is no effective oversight of the global business. There just isn't. There's no national regulatory authority that can do that. That's the lessons learned from GE and other large multinationals. There certainly is no oversight of the U.N., and so the temptation here, it evidently proved to be so great. And so let's get into the private server. The people, I happen to know a man who served in a top job where he was trying to think through for our federal government the threats posed by foreign governments, foreign businesses, to our economic security. And those of us, I mean, I'm not involved in government, never have been, never want to be, but I understand that the top secrets are held in what are called secure, compartmentalized, I forget what the I stands for, facilities, S-T-I-F. And that information is not supposed to leave those facilities. They're hardened facilities that people can't crack into. And so the notion that the Secretary of State would decide, quote, for her convenience, that they were going to set up this approach where a lot of information would be housed in D.C. and perhaps in New York and who knows where else, is preposterous on its face. If you talk to any person with experience in government who has understands how classified stuff needs to be treated, that's ridiculous. And the notion that she would try to do this and go ahead and do it and carry it out for 4 years, and then after she left would actually keep this information and unsupervised by any true stress tester, then decide what of our property she might deign to return to the United States, is ridiculous. And anybody who wants to defend that is a fool. And, you know, I even saw this morning, refreshingly, I happened to be turning on Morning Joe this morning, and I even watched in amazement as every member of that panel, I think it was Mika Brzezinski, Chuck Todd, and others, were all aghast, and they could not defend the indefensible. They didn't even try to. In fact, Chuck Todd said something I couldn't believe coming on the heels of his interview, softball interview this weekend of Mrs. Clinton. He said that in his view, and he may have to walk this one back, that Hillary Clinton could, if nominated to serve as Attorney General, could not be confirmed because of this report. And I agree with that. This is outrageous behavior.
Secretary Clinton served as Secretary of State from 2009 to 2013. And during that time, there was one very interesting thing. I raised it on this program, that for all of that time, one office that remained unfulfilled, unfilled, I should say, was that of the Inspector General. The Inspector General is essentially the agency's watchdog. Is that significant to you, that this particular post, during the entire tenure of Hillary Clinton at the State Department, this post went unfilled? Does that seem significant to you?
Absolutely, and it's standard Clinton procedure. I mean, that he follows a long train of their lives. They figured that out a long time ago. That, you know, the oldest question, when you go into, I think it's the Greek or Roman history, who regulates the regulator? That's the oldest question in, you know, democracy or in Republican forms of government. And the Clintons figured out that if you could create an office but leave it unfilled, or if you have to appoint somebody, restrict the field of inquiry of the Inspector General, then, you know, what you can do is you can delay and obstruct and stonewall, as they have in this case, so that by the time the subject actually bites the way it's biting now, they can say, you know, oh, it's old news, or it's partisan, or it's biased, or whatever. That's what they do all the time. And I think, you know, the American people on the right and the left are sick and tired of this. We are not stupid. We all understand, whether we're rich or poor, or whatever our ethnicity or gender, since the period since 2001 has not been a good period for us economically or geopolitically. This nation is suffering under massive debt. You can't save. Your job security just isn't there. All sorts of geopolitical problems. And let's go back to January 2001. By their own admission, these people were dead broke. How do you go from being dead broke to being worth who knows how much money, $100 million after tax, $200 million after tax, the kind of environment we've all dealt through, been through? You don't do it in post-government service or in government service. You certainly don't do it running a charity. You know, and it stinks to high heaven. And I think that, refreshingly, for the first time, I think that the standard Clinton playbook is not being bought by people who listen to your show, by the people who listen to Fox and other people. See this for what it is. Charity fraud is bad. It's indefensible. And in particular, I mean, we were talking the other day about Haiti. This is a charity that was never authorized to operate internationally and has picked off some of the most desperate places in the world. It's gotten between these desperate places and incoming aid flows and likely diverted perhaps billions of dollars in the case of Haiti, and billions more in other places. And yet, you know, puts out this propaganda on their website and their annual reports of all these starving children and women, you know, these plaintive photos that, you know, cause Americans and others to open their wallets, send money over the Internet. And, you know, the shame of that. I mean, how these people fall asleep at night and get up in the morning and hold themselves out to the world as if they're doing good, when they're running a global version on steroids at Tammany Hall.
Interestingly, I mean, this is all happening in a kind of coincidental way, but it is really startling in a sense. The FBI Justice Department investigation of Terry McAuliffe, who is a pivotal figure in the fundraising models that he designed and encouraged and ran for the Clintons, and then applied it to himself and propelled himself into politics and became governor. And he has been under close scrutiny for very unorthodox ways in which he also has run that office, a la Clinton, monetizing the connections and so forth to the Clintons and with the Clinton Foundation. A central figure in the investigation is a Chinese national, Wang Wenliang, who supposedly contributed $120,000 to his campaign, but it was just one of several major transactions that Wan Wenliang apparently engaged in, not only with McAuliffe, but also with the Clintons. And it involved the Clinton Foundation as a kind of pass-through, it seems. When you look at these connections, do you see something here that causes you to question how people are operating with each other? Is there, my journalistic instinct tells me, this business about the server, the invisible server that popped up, and then the guy who sets it up doesn't decides he's not going to talk. Hillary Clinton insists it was just merely for convenience. You've explained that this is just the most preposterous explanation ever, and that this kind of information is very valuable on the global scene where the decisions of governments, individual governments, could be so, so impactful that it is actually worth money. We hear reports. In fact, I saw a report filed by Michael Shearer just yesterday, in which he says that Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe invited this Chinese donor to Hillary Clinton's home. And in that home is where the server was, the secret server. Am I being a little bit overdramatic here by saying these things are just not coincidental? Why would this be considered normal, or to what degree for the Clintons in your experience? And you know Terry McAuliffe, and you've had some questions about his function with respect to the foundation and with the Clintons. What do you make of all of this? And it's all happening at the same time.
Well, you know, the Clintons are fond of saying that all Republicans do is dredge up old history, and we've got better things to do, and we got to move forward. To see this scandal for what it is, you have to have some context. Now, I'm not going to be getting into pre-1996 matters in the forthcoming set of reports, but I'm going to be starting around 1996 with Exhibit 1 this Sunday. And on my website, www.charlesmartel.com. But if you can remember back to 1996, that was a bitterly contested election, and Bill Clinton, from memory, defeated Bob Dole handily. But there were allegations leading up to the election, and then there were investigations after the election about whether Chinese government and other related entities were improperly supporting the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton campaign. There were extensive investigations of all that. And guess what? Back then, there were missing emails. And so, you know, this thing that they're looking at now doesn't start in a vacuum. One of the closest associates to the Clintons is a man called Ira Magaziner. He was involved with Hillary Clinton's failed attempt, to reform healthcare, and of course we need to reform healthcare. It still needs to be reformed. But and then he became internet czar back in I forget exactly what year, but let's say 1998. So here's a man who's a former consultant, a current consultant, a very smart man, a Rhodes Scholar, valedictorian of his class at Brown, then off to Oxford, stellar career as a McKinsey consultant, close friend of Clinton, and an internet expert. So here you have a private server. The first question I'd be asking is, when did the system, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, you know, when did the system of using a private server start? And my guess is it started way back. I would also guess that, you know, if I were at the FBI, working with my colleagues around the world, I would be thinking about, you know, where else there are servers. I don't think there's only one server in her house. I highly doubt that. I would guess that there's, you know, servers elsewhere, multiple servers. There's servers that, you know, the people operating the system, you know, thought were the only servers, and then people working with them said, you know what, this is a little dodgy, maybe I better protect myself by copying the records. And then, you know, from what I read, and I, you know, my kids joke about how backward I am in technology. My dad is a PhD in nuclear physics and an expert, and I'm an idiot when it comes to technology. It's a side story. But they have told me long ago, and in press reports, young people, and people like this Guccifer in some Romanian village, you know, they delight in seeing how they can hack into different things. As we speak, people are trying to hack into spy versus spy stuff. So how, over this long period of 20 years, let's say, 1996 to the present, how many hackers have successfully gotten into Ira Magaziner's home server? Hillary Clinton, Doug Band, Doug Band's father, Doug Band's brother, Uma Abedin, her mother, you name it. The list goes on and on and on. And I'm just, you know, fly-swatting ideas around. I mean, you've got people perhaps in Russia, dedicated experts on cyber security and hackers. You've got people in India, you got people in China, you got people here, you got people there. So this sort of an approach is a field day. It's an invitation to treason. It's an invitation to gross financial irregularity. Now, why would you do this for 20 years? I could see doing it for 15 seconds by accident. But why do you do it for 20 years? There's no good reason. So then the question becomes, in my mind, it's not so much their pattern and practice of illegal activity. The question is, why has this been allowed to go unprosecuted for so long? Now, why have the different state attorney generals not leapt, particularly in New York, on the Clinton Foundation? Their records are so far out of compliance and have been for years. Why are they doing nothing? Is it because the attorney general is a Democrat? Is it because the governor worked for Bill Clinton in his first presidential term? Is it that bold? And, you know, I'll remind people that here in New York City we have problems, at the state level we have problems, it's Republican, it's Democrat. Not, you know, it's not simply a partisan issue. Why has this gone along? I wrote an article in March of 2015 saying, with so many red flags, why hasn't the IRS audited the Clinton Foundation? The answer likely is there's another Lois Lerner there.
Well, here's another why. Here's another why question. Considering the very bad blood that became evident between Barack Obama and the Clintons during Obama's run, both times, well, less so than the second go-round, because by then it was clear that they had arrived at some point of agreement and some kind of an arrangement. But there was bad blood between them. So it was a puzzle for people to come to terms with the fact that despite this bad blood, Hillary Clinton nonetheless emerged with a very nice prize, the prize of Secretary of State. And one would ask the question, if in fact they had come to some kind of terms about, well, we had many differences of opinion, but I value your expertise and your experience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I'm going to name you Secretary of State. Okay. But one is, it's clear that when one is to be appointed, they find out everything. What's your shoe size? What's your grandma's shoe size? You know, where did your great-grandfather come from? And one would imagine that by then, questions about the Clinton Foundation and its operations and its unusual fundraising methods and other things related to it would have been a factor in the vetting process of Mrs. Clinton for Secretary of State. What, in your view, explains the fact that she became Secretary of State nonetheless, despite the fact that there was this cloud hanging over the Clinton Foundation?
That is a great question, and you're scooping me a little bit, but let's make some news together, and I'll get into it. The actual dates that are important, I believe it was the 7th of June, 2008. That was the date, I think that was around the California primary in that election cycle, where Hillary Clinton reluctantly conceded that Barack Obama was going to be the Democrat nominee. Now, there was talk, just so people understand this, that for a foundation normally that has a calendar year end must file its forms by May 15th of the subsequent year. So the 2007 forms were due May 15th. You can get an automatic 3-month extension that will put you out to August. But to get beyond that date, you have to explain, and you can't lie when you ask for the extension. You have to explain precisely why they needed more time. Now, at this moment, Barack Obama and his team had no access. Maybe they might have had access, but they shouldn't have had access to anything going on at the IRS. They couldn't possibly have known what was really going on with the Clinton Foundation and its filing. They might have had access, let's say, in Illinois or other states where they had ties to the state regulators' files on the Clinton Foundation. But I have been studying them for 15 months, and I could tell you that the Clinton Foundation was in deep financial trouble by 2007. Its core operation, the Clinton Foundation, what was called then the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS Initiative, Inc., had filed an application in April of 2004 for federal tax exemption. I see no evidence that it ever received such exemption. It solicited money across state lines and internationally. It operated in countries illegally. It did submit what's called a 990 annual report for 2004 and 2005, but there is no evidence that this thing operated all during 2005. There's no evidence that it had submitted a 990 for 2005, at least not on their website, and none that I've been scouring Europe looking for it. That's illegal. There is, however, evidence, if you go on the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Attorney General charity site online and the corporation search site, you will find evidence that that entity that I was talking about had its license to operate involuntarily revoked with effect from December 31st, 2007 on March 31, 2008. Now, that is a very material fact that should have been told to the IRS at all fundraisers. Everywhere. That should have shut the foundation down, that simple thing. And Terry McAuliffe was a trustee of the parent. He should have known about that. John Podesta, involved in the campaign, he should have known about that. He's a lawyer. He runs a 501, the charity anyway, or he ran Center for American Progress. So these people should have all known that the thing was in deep, deep distress. And indeed, the financials are a mess. You know, where it had been making money, you know, or generating more revenues than expenses, by 2007 it was not. By 2008 it was getting even worse. And what they had done is they had successfully used various people, the good offices of perhaps Rajat Gupta, McKinsey guy, and Bill Gates and others, to gain this tremendous strategic link to a Switzerland-based company, supposed charity, that was sending hundreds of millions of dollars into this Boston thing that it had its license to operate involuntarily revoked. So you're talking one incredible mess. Now, after June 7th, there was talk of Hillary Clinton's supporters, you look this up, mounting a floor fight, much as there is talk now of, you know, Bernie Sanders challenging Hillary if it looks like he doesn't, so that she can't garner the delegates. There was talk of that, then it quieted down. And you could check the press accounts, I won't get into them, but there were some extremely offensive comments made by Bill Clinton about Barack Obama. Then scroll forward through to the election. Bill and Hillary were loyal, you know, in the season. Now Barack Obama wins this historic election, first African-American. It's really a triumph for him. He ran a great campaign. And it, in many ways, a triumph and, it offered the possibility of a great redemption in American politics. He had a high point. He was on top of the world. The Democrats controlled the House and the Senate. There were a lot of speculation that the various members around President Obama, elect Obama, did not want to see Hillary Clinton involved. So it is shocking to me to look at the draft memorandum of understanding dated November 16th, 2008, that is a legal joke. You talk to any of the lawyers and your listeners will know that a memorandum of understanding has no legal force and effect. It is set up that way precisely to have no legal force and effect. There was no consideration offered. There are legal drafting errors in it. It did not bind Bill Clinton. He's not a signatory. And it made false and materially misleading claims in the recital portion about the status of the Clinton Foundation and about the status of this HIV/AIDS thing. So why would President Obama, I mean, you know, riding high on the 16th of November, why would you ever, Valerie Jarrett signed and sent the draft to the transition team on that date, the 16th of November, why would she have done that? Now, at the same time, there were investigations were mounting into what had happened with Bogeyevich, the former, former or current governor of Illinois then, what's been current, who it had been rumored was trying to sell to the highest bidder Barack Obama's Senate seat. And the FBI, I believe, around the same time was interviewing Valerie Jarrett, was interviewing Barack Obama. So why would the incoming president of the United States agree to give a very powerful position to a husband and wife team who had a record, if you looked under close scrutiny, that was horrible, even back then, and then look the other way as this foundation operated with impunity illegally around the world? Why would you do that? And, you know, our press has been asleep. Our mainstream press, even, you know, CNN and forget the hard right side of it, but, you know, our press has been asleep looking at this. And these are serious questions. I actually spoke to a man who wrote a book about Hillary Clinton and asked him these questions, and he hadn't thought about these issues.
I talked about it all the time. I said, this woman is completely unqualified for this job. And goal, this unprecedented prize he's gotten, now gives this job to a person who is absolutely unqualified for it. What do you think might have happened there?
Well, I'll tell you, I know a fair amount about this. I mean, I've actually gone, and I'll encourage your listeners to do the same thing. Go on to the New York State Charity Bureau website and look at the filings in relation to 2007, all of the filings for the Clinton Foundation, and you will see a correspondence file. What the Clinton Foundation did is they purposely withheld. Remember, Hillary was a senator from New York at the time, so it wouldn't have been such a great thing to have a foundation operating in New York flagrantly in fraud. I mean, that would have probably not helped her get confirmed if people knew about that. So what they did is they held up filings. They purposely filed them late. And she and her team jobbed the Senate confirmation process. So they withheld, they lied in filings. You can see that they say they need more time to file their audit because their auditor hadn't completed it. Then when they file it, you look at the date of the audit and it had been completed. So they purposely, in New York anyway, they gamed the system. And they gamed the process of being confirmed. If you go through the actual testimony, as I have, you'll find that, you know, there's public record that some senators had serious questions about this. You know, noted at the time the potential for conflict of interest, and pious remarks were made by various people, oh, yeah, don't worry, we'll comply. They never did. Never did. Right away, you know, with speech-making time, we only have some of the records of how approvals were sought. And that reminds me, you know, I didn't answer a question that you asked in the very beginning. How did Hillary Clinton get the right to just decide to do this private server without checking with anybody? I mean, who gave her that? I'm not aware that that's how it works. I thought, you know, the President of the United States was a pretty powerful job, and in government you sort of had to check with him on major stuff. And if you're not going to deal with him directly, you know, wouldn't Valerie Jarrett or somebody like that have had to be consulted on this? I mean, you just can't go ahead and say, look, you know, I've got Rock, you know, I've got, you know, the rest of the world. You deal with the 50 states, you know, I'll take care of the rest of the world. I don't need to check with anybody. I mean, there's got to have been a process in place in prior administrations that would serve as a model here of what you can and can't do as a cabinet official.
Well, the Clintons are known for playing political hardball all the time. I want to go back to this question about her appointment to Secretary of State after such an open, vitriolic relationship that they had, both Bill and Hillary, in terms of Barack Obama. I don't know how else to ask the question except to say, do you suspect that there was serious political hardball played here to the point of an including possibly extorting this position?
It's not a crazy line of inquiry. I mean, you know, I think that if we look at the Clinton record, just look at known facts, and you know, we don't need to worry about conspiracy theories. The Clintons definitely countenanced, if not led, the pilfering of approximately 900 FBI files on Republicans, principally. Now, that's what's known, right? That's when Bill was president. That's what we know. Now, we don't know whether the Clintons also got files on Democrats. But somebody who would be so brazen as to get into an FBI file, and I'm told by experts that an FBI file, you know, it's not like it's, when the FBI investigates something, they go down lots of blind alleys. So there can be unproven or unsubstantiated concerns or concerns that were washed away. And that's why you don't really release an FBI file to the public, because, you know, it's your note, not the finished work product. So it was outrageous to do that. Is it possible that the Clintons also got FBI files on Barack Obama and other people? And I would say anybody who would do it on the Republicans would certainly be thinking about, you know, not advancing the Democratic Party, but advancing the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. So have the Clintons been known to play tough ball? Have they, you know, are they the ones who pioneered the use of a war room against opponents? Did they lead vicious assaults or have surrogates lead vicious assaults against their enemies? Yes, they did. So might they, you know, would they have done opposition research on Barack Obama? Of course they did. Now, are there holes in Barack Obama's record that are not, you know, satisfactorily explained? Perhaps. You know, but the point here, it doesn't make sense. It would not make sense to me to give the Clintons unfettered reign over contacts with foreign leaders that are valuable, while allowing a foundation that was not permitted, not authorized to go internationally, and whose books and records were in horrible condition in 2007-08, to go ahead and do what they did while she was Secretary of State. And furthermore, you know, one thing, since you bring it up, that's extremely odd to me, is that, you know, though the Clinton Foundation efforts were made to reorganize it in various ways, where are the emails relating to that? You know, how come there aren't emails back and forth from the IRS and other people to the Clintons saying, you know, we've just taken a look at your authorizations and we don't understand why you were operating internationally, or we don't understand this. There's no emails relating to the reorganization of the Clinton Foundation, which did in fact happen. You know, why did they create a new HIV/AIDS thing with the same acronym, CHAI, called Clinton Health Access Initiative? Why did they begin that process September 29th, 2009? Why did they set up a new Clinton Global Initiative on September 4th, 2009? Why did they do it that day? Why did the meeting happen in September 2009, but the IRS application not go into August of 2010? You know, and how do you say with the Clinton Global Initiative that operated and had a meeting, I think a fifth or sixth meeting in 2009, a subsequent one in 2010, how do you say on an IRS application to create it that it was not a successor organization when it had been operating from September 2005? And on and on and on. How come there aren't questions back and forth on all the above? You know, there's a lot to me. I think, you know, with the Clintons, what they say is the record is never the record. So when they say there were 55,000 emails, I start by saying that's not correct. Well, most likely there are more emails that we don't know about. So it's not that we started with 55 and they deigned to give us whatever the number is, 35 or 20 missing. You know, maybe there's not 200,000 emails or 300,000 emails. And, you know, we still don't know how many have been flying around. And that's just not the way this is supposed to work. I'm aware of a firm in the securities area that was disciplined by the regulators because its principals were using private emails. And why do you do that? Because when a regulator is trying to regulate somebody, you can't let the people operating directly in the State Department use personal email for important business. You certainly can't let them do it using an alias, as Chelsea Clinton was doing, as a trustee, a former cabinet person was doing. And who knows? Does Hillary Clinton have alias emails? Does Bill have alias emails? Does Doug Pan? Who knows?
In her capacity as Secretary of State, and also as an agent of the Clinton Foundation, Hillary Clinton had access to a lot of freebies at taxpayer expense, and one of them is, of course, travel, hotel accommodation, security, and the like. She put in quite a bit of mileage as Secretary of State. In fact, she put in 956,733 miles of travel during her tenure and visited a number of countries, second only to Condoleezza Rice in the number of countries visited. Considering that at the time she was also an operative of the Clinton Foundation, should that not have also entered into the purview of, well, there was no inspector general at the time, but somebody should have raised a question that there appears to be, if not conflict of interest, but opportunity for conflict of interest. In your dealings, in your perusal of the figures and the records, do you see any correlation between the travel of Hillary Clinton and business dealings and money that flowed from those countries to the Clinton Foundation?
Absolutely. I mean, I had the privilege of going to the screening of the Clinton Cash Book by Peter Schweitzer, where he documents a number of those things. But there's one that I believe will come out soon, and it's a deeper dive into the situation in Colombia. And in the case of Colombia, Hillary and Bill she is Secretary of State, he in his private capacity, happened to be visiting the country at the same time. And in the midst of that, magically, the person who gave Bill Youssef his jet down to Colombia ended up with extremely valuable concessions from Colombia to exploit resources in virgin forests. Horrible thing that they did, frankly, from an environmental standpoint. Forestry resources, oil and gas resources. This is in connection with an entity called Pacific Rubialis. And, you know, this is a deep story. It needs a lot of work. There's some big names involved with it. The Carlos Slim of Mexico was involved in this. Frank Schuster is involved in this. Canada. And, yeah, I mean, there are numerous examples. And there's the uranium story in Kazakhstan and in the U.S. Country after country, people close to the Clintons have managed to get enormously valuable, multi-billion-dollar concessions from various governments. I'll give you another case. This is one that has not yet been fleshed out. There's a country in the Middle East that people pronounce it out there, gutter, but it's spelled Q-A-T-A-R.
Yes, Qatar.
Yeah, and there's an entity out there called, it was called the Gutter Telecommunication Company. It, you know, as these things will do to get some PR person comes to you and says, no, you got to rebrand. So it's now called Urdu. I forget the exact spelling. It's like O-U-R-E-D-O-O, something like that. The old Qatar Telecom Company. Well, one of these great commitments for action, which I think is a meaningless construct, that's bragged about on the Clinton Foundation website, is one involving the Clinton Global Initiative and this Qatar Telecommunications Company. Clinton Global Initiative sent volunteers into rural Burma and rural Indonesia to ask women what features they wanted. A cell phone. Now, as if a volunteer is going to be all that affected in the deep wilds of Indonesia and Burma, and as if you could have any control over that, and as if doing a marketing study for a Qatari-based telecom provider is actually charitable work. Nonetheless, they did it, and they brag about it. And wouldn't you know, lo and behold, that this Urdu gets licenses, valuable licenses, to operate in Burma, which is, you know, a virgin playing field that had been locked behind the authoritarian government for a long period of time, and in Indonesia. So this Qatari-based, publicly traded company, heavily influenced by the ruler of Qatar, the royal family of Qatar, through intercession and operation of the Clinton Foundation, derives an enormous, in the billions probably, if you look at their maybe high hundred millions, billions, increase in its share value because it gets these licenses. That's an example. One example right there. Now, Qatar, we can debate I'm somebody who feels that their support for radical movements around the world is horrible, and I don't like that country and its foreign policies, and I think the American people should ask very tough questions about why we are close to that, that we, the United States of America, are close to the government of Qatar and the royal family there. But this is, the technical term for it is called enormous, bright line enormous. It's the appropriation of, it's the creation of substantial private gain and appropriation by insiders. So who benefited from this deal? This is not charitable operation. This is just business development for a repressive regime in Qatar that's accused of using slave labor.
But what you've been explaining seems to go far beyond the strict business of how charities are supposed to operate. This suggests actually criminal activity.
Exactly. That's it. That's why I'm right now. I was asked, I was speaking to, I won't say who, and they were saying, why do you have such passion in your voice? Is this, you know, that's a problem. I mean, I'm proud to be an American citizen. You know, I'm very proud of this country for all its faults. I think there's, on balance, far more special about this country. Whatever your political persuasion, I've traveled, at last count, I think it was to 65 countries out of the 200. I have seen some horrors in places that are rich, you know, but that just stand today in abject poverty. This is a country where if you're willing to roll up your sleeves and work hard and learn a skill, you are going to do well, even with all the problems. And so when I see a former president who is not stupid, and his wife, who is not stupid, and daughter, who are not stupid, get involved in something that is really a celebrity charity that gets tremendous attention around the world, and then fall down so abjectly, failing to comply, you know, with state, federal, and foreign laws, and getting intertwined with a collection of sordid characters around the world, people who've been accused and convicted of fraud and horrible things around the world, and then go before us and try to act as if their mother Teresa. You know, it's crazy. And so, of course, I mean, I've been bringing this up and bringing it up, and thanks to you, Yatrice, and others, we're finally getting some real attention, bipartisan or nonpartisan. Look at this. And the charitable world, actually, when you think about it, it leans left. People involved with charities, there's so many decent people out there giving of their time, giving money, trying to make a difference in this world. And they play by the rules. So, you know, to allow a president and somebody who wants to be president to do this kind of stuff and then give people in repressive regimes the excuse of saying, you know, we can't trust charities because, you know, you never know what they're really up to. You know, without making an example of this, without showing what they did, what was the real record, letting everybody take a look, let us absorb this pattern of criminality. Let us absorb the fact together that, you know, state regulators will either missed it or saw about it and enabled it. Federal regulators did the same thing. Foreign leaders did the same thing. This has got to be a huge wake-up call. You can do enormous damage, as we discussed in Haiti. You can do enormous damage in these poor countries if you allow a charity, a false charity, a Robin Hood in reverse, rich people exploiting poor people. And the guise of charity is a horrible crime. And it's not, as Bill Clinton said, you know, 10 days ago or so, it's just a minor traffic ticket. This is not a traffic ticket. This is running over multiple children who approached the charity thinking that it was a force for good and killing them. It's a horrible, horrible crime, and you know, it needs to be fully exposed, appreciated, and prosecuted.
You've done so much work already in the past 15 months, and you're posting what you've discovered, and you're posting documents on your website, charlesortel.com. What is the next blockbuster that you have coming?
Well, if you go on my website, there are 40 exhibit titles. It gives you a sense of each of the subjects. Just to have your listeners and yourself, if you have time, just spend some time reading. Most I'm somebody who doesn't mind tables and charts, and I know that the general audience doesn't. They see a table with many, many entries, and they say, oh, I don't want to look at that. But do yourself, if you do me a favor and just look at the exhibit titles, and remember that this just deals with areas that you need to understand to grasp the full extent of the scandal. And the history solely between 1997 and 2010. I haven't even put up, there's 40 topics, and I haven't even gotten to the period 2011 to the present. When you see and read through these exhibits, go on my site and go back to the beginning, go to April 20th, 2015, and read the reports that I put up there. Absorb them. What I'm doing, Utrecht, to answer the question is I'm watching carefully developments. I mean, they've been so fast and furious in the last one. Really, every time we get on the air, we get off the air and then something new happens. So what I do is I watch what's happening, and then I summarize, and I'm somebody who, you give me a deadline, and I work right up to the deadline. I will spend this weekend, you know, seeing what happened, and then I'll tie it all together in the new demo, trying to explain what I think is important. And with luck, showing you just Exhibit 1, the illegal fundraising practices that started in the very beginning while Bill Clinton was still president.
What reaction have you gotten so far as a one-man crusader?
Well, it's fun. It's very gratifying. You know, it's people are fond of framing American politics as you know, it's a bipartisan zero-sum game. And one of the nicest things that I'm seeing here is that, and I see it on my Twitter feed, which I watch carefully, is it's people, believe it or not, on the left and on the right who are outraged by this. And I'm getting emails coming in. If you contact me via the site, it goes to my email. And I'm getting emails coming in and introductions here and introductions there. And, you know, again, people on the hard left, people on the hard right, they look at this and they can agree. Here's an area we can agree. Charity fraud is awful. You know, the charity sector in this country is a marvel. The good that is done on balance is incredible. The quiet support for the people who are really afflicted, the thoughtful support, it's amazing. And so people are, you know, coming together and encouraging me. And next week, actually, I'm going to be down in Washington, D.C. for a number of days. And, you know, I'm hopeful that the FBI is doing its work, hard work. I'm hopeful that state regulators will start digging in here. I'm hopeful that foreign governments that I will be contacting soon will start doing their work. And I'm seeing that the mainstream media is digging in and looking at this. And, you know, I should also add that, you know, many months ago, I reached out to powerful Democrats, because I knew a lot of this months ago. And I said, you know, you're not going to take this advice from me, but you really should. America needs a series of Lincoln-Douglas debates. You know, if there are two different ways through this, you know, one towards Bernie, one towards Trump, or whatever it is, let's have a real set of debates where, you know, substantive differences are laid out before the American people, and let's have a real election, give a real mandate, whichever way we decide, and let's disrupt this government, which is bloated, ineffective, not helping the American people. And let's get a new model together, availing ourselves of the tools that are out there, and let's fix the problems. I don't care about fighting for the problem. Let's fix the problem. Let's take one a week, and let's fix it. You know, and I'm beginning to see that people are starting to think like that, and it's nice.
I want to thank you so much, Charles Ortel, for being with us today and adding even more dimension to this incredible story, and we will continue following. And I know you're going to be working through the weekend, but hopefully there's something new again to report sometime next week. But I want to thank you so much for providing this expert analysis. This is a major story. We've raised it here on this program several times about Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. And the way the Clintons generally operate. And it is interesting that you are coming at this from an entirely different angle, but you are letting us see how the thinking is manifesting in actions that are highly questionable. And this, in a way, gives yet another opportunity for those who are in the business of putting things right to take a look and see that things are put right. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Utrice. Thank you, you and your colleagues and your families. And also thanks so much to the men and women in the armed services, current and retired, who've done so much to protect our liberty.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of our program today. I am sure that it raised a lot of questions, and it answered, hopefully, a lot more questions as well. But in any event, this is an ongoing story, and so we will be following this and adding onto it as more and more information becomes available. I must say thanks, a very special thanks to Charles Ortel, because this is a person who is very, very dedicated to the idea of fairness. And when things are wrong, when people are lying, and when companies and organizations are being deceptive to the point of penalizing the people, he has a special outrage about that. And this is what he does. He just spends a lot of time going through the numbers, and the numbers aren't going to lie. So this has been a really incredible insight into the Clinton Foundation, into the actions and the deeds of the Clintons, and it will continue. I'm sure next week we will get some more dimensions to this story. So thanks so much for listening. Tomorrow, of course, is Free Your Mind Friday. Get your brains in gear for that. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. Let me know what you think about the program so far and what you're learning. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.